Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Tristan Cruz Limsico from Amsterdam, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you, and hello, Tristan in Amsterdam. That's a very cool name,
isn't
and
it? Oh, I love that
very
name.
Very cool place to live. Well, I say that I've not actually been to Amsterdam, but once travel is possible again, I would love to go. But yeah, not for a while, I'm sure. But anyway, thank you, Tristan, and thank you for backing us in last year's Kickstarter. Thank you to everybody that has backed us in this year's Kickstarter. We have reached our target. We are still crowdfunding. It's open for another 45 days, I think, up to the start of the Australian Open. Look, we've hit our target. We will be bringing you podcasts next year, and they will be bigger and better. And if David Law has anything to to do with it, more numerous than even this year. But if you want to chip in, do your bit and be part of it, or get yourself an intro, or be part of our predictions competition, or a shout out, or a private podcast, or become a guest editor, any of those things are possible. If you just want to buy us a beer or some cheese, or, you know, a new front tooth, any of those things, then you're very welcome to do so. And all of it will be appreciated, and all of it will be put to good use. You know, we'd love to be able to guarantee you that we'll do a certain amount of travel next year and travel to events specifically for the podcast. We really hope that that's what we'll be putting a lot of funds to use for next year. But obviously, we're not in a position to be able to absolutely guarantee that at this stage because of the pesky old pandemic.
Yeah.
And speaking of the old coronavirus, it would seem, and this isn't absolutely confirmed, but it would seem, this is via reports from John Wertheim, who is a very reliable source, and he's reporting it quite confidently, that Indian Wells is on the brink of being cancelled for 2021.
Mm. Yeah, it's another jarring moment, isn't it? Because that's where all of this started. It at least became moved into our consciousness in a really visceral, immediate way when it was cancelled the night before you were about to fly there. And I think the assumption was really that as the year went on, particularly, I suppose particularly now that there is a vaccine on the horizon, albeit however long far down the road in terms of everybody being able to benefit from it, the assumption was that 2021 things will start to hopefully get back to normal and that Indian Wells will be able to happen at least, you know, because that didn't happen last year. And to think that 2 years in a row it may well not run is quite hard to take. It's, look, grand scheme of things, I know it's not as big a deal in people's lives as many others, but in the tennis world, that is another moment, really, another point in time that just shows how devastating this virus has been to the world and to the sporting world.
Obviously, it'll open up a gap in the calendar, which may be enticing to some tournaments. I wonder if it'll be enticing to Tennis Australia, who we've heard reports that they will sort of plan an Australian swing post the Australian Open to try and make it more worthwhile, players coming over and quarantining. The current situation in terms of reports on that, on when the Australian Open and surrounding events will happen. And there's a number of very reputable sources reporting this as well. John Wertheim, the Spanish newspaper Marca, reporting this, that the most likely scenario is the Australian Open taking place 3 weeks later than planned, so starting on February the 8th. With a quarantine period beginning from January 15th, and then a week's practice week, possibly with an additional warm-up tournament that week taking place immediately prior to the Australian Open. And crucially, qualifying is reported to be taking place not in Australia, most likely in the Middle East, possibly Dubai, and that would be 3 weeks prior to the Australian Open, so that any successful qualifiers would still be able to complete the quarantine period in Australia. And crucially, you wouldn't have to travel to Australia and complete the quarantine period only to fall in the first round of qualifying, which I imagine would be a pretty heartbreaking scenario and a bitter pill to swallow. Where that leaves Australian players or Southern Hemisphere players that would play qualifying, I don't know. I mean, it's obviously not a perfect solution, but I can see, Matt, why it's quite a logical solution given the circumstances we're dealing with.
I think in these difficult situations, you have to go with what benefits the most people as possible. And for the majority of players, the Middle East is on the way to Australia. Lots of them stop there in normal times anyway to play a warm-up event for the Australian Open. I mean, all the reports are making quite a lot of sense, I think. But obviously, these are still reports. We don't know that this will happen, but we're thinking it will. As David said, it's kind of still a bit disconcerting that, you know, we're so close to this and we still don't know for sure the solution, and we're heading into 2021 with yet more uncertainty. I know that's just the reality at the moment, but it's not easy, and I'm sure it's not easy for the players, not knowing when and where they're going to be starting their seasons.
Just an idea, by the way, for Australian qualifiers.
Qualifying relived.
Now we're talking. If I were a Tennis Australia, I think what I would do is make all the wild cards Australian and have a qualifying competition in Australia for those wild cards.
They'll certainly have to do something separate for Australian players. It's pretty ludicrous to expect them to, or even want them to travel outside of Australia. That's not going to happen. There will be a solution if the powers that be are listening to this, David. I'm sure it'll be that solution because it seems to make perfect sense to me. There are also reports that Dubai will be a season opener on the WTA tour. Obviously, ordinarily, both tours hold an event in Dubai back-to-back weeks. So I suppose it could become an ATP tour opener. But at the moment, the reports are just that would be a WTA tour opener, which it again sounds like a not too shabby idea. I mean, it's tennis taking place in the sun, which is really what I'm hoping for from January.
Yeah, it's one big movable feast, isn't it, at the moment? And I think that the Australian government's reaction to all of Tennis Australia's plans over the last 6 weeks have probably taken Tennis Australia by surprise in just how unaccommodating they've been to some of the plans. And some of the quite proactive interviews and comments that Craig Tiley, who's a very innovative tournament director, and somebody who is out there in terms of making his thoughts available and known, I think maybe they might have taken exception to some of them and decided that they were not going to be told what they're going to be doing, or just making it very clear that their situation is the important one. Tennis can fit in. And absolutely fair enough, really, from a public health perspective. But it does mean that I think tennis has to be incredibly flexible right now. Just make the damn thing work somehow around whatever you've got. That's all they can do. I mean, ideally, it wouldn't be in this position. Maybe there's something that could have been done differently. I don't know. I'm not party to the discussions. Maybe the planning could have been better. I just don't know. But from here, where we are right now, it's just got to make it work somehow.
Yeah, please just make some tennis happen. And apparently, if there is a practice week in Australia, sort of post-quarantine period prior to Australian Open, apparently players will have to pick a designated other player to be their practice partner for the week. So that will be like a sort of, you know, Love is Blind type dating program.
If you could have
for tennis players,
any male and any female player alone as your practice partner, who would you have? I'd have John Millman.
Well, I don't know what are desirable traits in a practice partner. I think you don't want somebody that is, you don't want a trick shot guy or girl.
Exactly. Bublik is out.
Yeah, I'm not having Roger
Federer. Yeah, you don't want that.
Bublik was the first name that came to mind. I do not want to practice with you for 2 or 3 weeks.
You want a nice, steady ball, I think.
Yeah, you want David Goffin.
You want a human ball machine, David Goffin.
Yeah, I'm having John Millman and I'm bringing Caroline Wozniacki out of retirement.
Yes, or Simona Halep, I think, would probably be great.
Yes.
She still gets angry at herself, though, and then I'm not, you know.
Well, I think that's fine. That's over the other end of the court.
You might be able to get some Darren Cahill inputs if you have Simona Halep
listen in.
Yeah.
I don't think you want Nadal.
No, you'd be knackered.
Yeah.
You're scared.
Yeah. Your tournament's over before it started.
And he hits the ball harder in practice, doesn't he? So it would be terrifying. I'm not sure you want Dominic Thiem. Yeah. But Bublik will be left on the bench. And I don't think he'll mind.
No.
That is what's happening. Well, or might be happening. Who knows what's happening? More uncertainty about the start of next year.
I'm having Kiki Bertens and John Millman.
Oh, well, Wozniacki's been dropped then.
Well, she's still retired. She wasn't having it. I tried to persuade her to come out of retirement, but she said no.
In slightly more comforting, reassuring news from the last week, Roger Federer has reacquired his RF logo, which of course was sort of lost in the ether when he switched sponsorship from Nike to, is it Uniqlo?
Correct.
Yes, Uniqlo. Well, they're not going to sponsor us, are they? Well done, Catherine. Uniqlo, great brand, brilliant. They've acquired the
sales
RF logo.
Pitch by Catherine.
Wonderful. And his announcement of this news was via a online video which was just laden with dad jokes.
Amazing.
It was so wonderfully comforting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's Federer we're very familiar with. And, yeah, he sort of pretended that they were in a box and they weren't in a box and then suddenly they were all next to him. And, yeah, I mean, it is quite a big deal for him to have that logo back. I mean, that's probably the thing you see that's tennis-related most outside of a tennis environment, possibly. Just like there have definitely been instances where I've just been walking along the street and I've seen people in Federer hats. You know, that is a big deal, that logo for him.
And last bit of news, if you can call it that, before we move on to our awards show, is that Karolina Pliskova has identified a coach that she hasn't already worked with, and she's employed him.
Yeah, and he has identified a player he hasn't worked with as well. It's Sasha Bajin or Bajin, I'm not really sure. But anyway, it's an interesting alliance. I think Pliskova has worked. She recently split with Dani Valverde. She's worked with Conchita Martinez, Thomas Krupa, I think.
Renee Stubbs.
Jiří Vanek. And Sasha Bajin has coached Caroline Wozniacki all been a hitting partner with Victoria Azarenka, Serena Williams, Naomi Osaka, Kristina Mladenovic, and Diana Yastremska most recently. And I mean, look, he's the players that he's worked with have had some exceptional results, including Osaka with two Grand Slams. And it will just be very interesting because Pliskova, I think we had come to the conclusion, was a player who was never going to win a Grand Slam despite her top five in the world consistency. I'd come to that final view over the last year or 18 months. And I do think that this association just has me interested as to whether that might change because he is different. He does seem to get different results out of people compared to their norm. I mean, even the brief time he was with Mladenovic, she had some really good results. So we'll see.
That's the thing with Pliskova, isn't it? That sense of doing something different for the slams. It feels like she plays the whole year on one level, if you like. And that level has been more than good enough to win so many tour events and big tour events. And she's been world number one, and yes, she has reached a Grand Slam final, but that was quite a few years ago now, and it's felt like she's declined at the Slams. And this is some fresh impetus, and that kind of feels like what she needed to do something different and see if that will work at the Slams. But there's so much that goes into a coaching relationship. It's almost impossible to predict whether they're going to work out successfully. But just from that perspective of doing something different, I think it's an encouraging move.
Mm. I mean, it's so clear what needs to happen with Pliskova in terms, you know, what she'll be looking for from a coach and what will count as success. You know, he needs to try and unlock her potential and make her a Grand Slam champion, which is what we all thought she would turn out to be. Frankly, if she ends her career without being a Grand Slam champion, given the opportunities there have been in women's tennis during her period, that will not have been achieving her game potential. So it's a very clear kind of target for them. Yeah, it is going to be interesting. So that's news. I think that's everything covered. Which brings us on to our end of year awards show. Now, you might remember from last year when we recorded this, it was immediately following our live show, which we hold every year or have held every year for the past 3 years. We held it this year on this Saturday just gone. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, in some respects, it had to be held on Zoom. But we did not let that perturb us. And in fact, you know, the one bonus of that was that our invitees from countries other than the UK and from parts of the UK that were less accessible for the live show, which has always been held in London, were able to come. And that was really, really lovely. It was for people that had backed us at predictions level and higher. So if you do that for next year, be able to come to our live show, which we hope will be, you know, in an actual room all together again next year. I hope that's not too much to hope for. We held it at Queen's last year. But anyway, it was on Zoom and it was lovely. And yeah, thank you for coming to that. And I hope you enjoyed it if you did. And we're going to do it all again now. Yay.
Yeah.
And there are 8 categories. The winners have already been decided because they were voted on Saturday, but I'll do a big dramatic reveal for the listeners. So David and Matt, if you could sort of pretend like you don't know that you've won or lost your category.
I can't remember now.
That would be great. I mean, to be honest, there were plenty of categories where all three were worthy winners, I think.
Yes, and there were also probably a couple of categories where there was a very clear standout and we sort of added extra options for the purpose of debate and discussion.
Yeah, for the lols.
Yes.
Yeah.
There were a couple where I got 0 votes, so.
Yes, and I'm very sorry to everybody that weren't, everybody that wasn't able to attend on Saturday missed the sort of the moment where I requested votes for David Law and there was just a tumbleweed across the Zoom gallery.
Despite my oh, I did a good job too. And I'm going to do it again
now. At least
now.
You didn't have a sort of panel of your family members, David, not voting for you, which is what I was confronted with.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every cloud.
I got frequently my parents joined separately, so they were in separate boxes, and Rosie was sort of darting between the two the two rooms. So I was frequently getting distracted by dog action, which is just fine.
Pressuring for certain votes.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Rosie. Lovely. Okay, so category number one, there are eight of these. We've each got a nominee in each category. We'll make our cases, and then I'll tell you who won. Great format.
And we've got some honourable mentions.
And some honourable mentions, courtesy of our crowdsourcing,
yes.
Which wasn't included on Saturday, which actually, you know, I'm not generally a fan of sort of asking people what they think on the internet. But there have been some really, really interesting responses. So thank you very much. Thank you, internet, for not dredging up awfulness.
Our internet mostly is pretty good. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know I always focus on the one idiot and not the 150 lovely people.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you.
I'm trying to get
her
out of that.
Right, let's start the awards. We start with Player of the Year. And I would like to make the case for Sophia Kenin for this, because she reached the final of two-thirds of the Grand Slams that she played this year. She won one of them, obviously, and the manner that she did that, the game she played, I think the fifth game of the third set, coming from love 40 down and playing what she described as the five best points of her life, will live with me forever, I think, that game. And to be honest, I was thinking about this. I actually find it a bigger achievement that she went on to reach the French Open final in the same year than that she reached that Australian Open final and won it. You know, we have had a lot of, well, perhaps not a lot of, but we've had a fair smattering of surprise Grand Slam champions and finalists in women's tennis over the last decade. And not many of them, even these sort of the players that were less of a surprise than Kenin at the time, not many of them have gone on to reach another final, certainly not in the same year. Ostapenko, you know, I thought of Dominika Sibulkova, Sara Rani did reach a couple of French Open finals, but, you know, not the same year. I find that more of a surprise, actually. And she won another title on top of that. You know, she showed consistency throughout the year. And let's face it, this is all with quite a limited game. You know, there's no big weapon that you can look at and say that is the reason she's doing this. But I think people were picking her to be sort of a player that's there or thereabouts in the top 20. I didn't hear anybody picking her out as a future Grand Slam champion. She doesn't even look at the tennis ball when she's serving. So I find it all pretty extraordinary. And her results this year speak for themselves. David, who's your player of the year?
Well, when I was looking at the list of possibles, I did think, you know, there really isn't an absolute standout here this year. It's not completely obvious to me. I think Rafael Nadal would be a good choice, you know, for what he did at the French Open. I think Naomi Osaka would be an excellent choice, having won the US Open and in the manner that she did it. And I definitely think Kenin is... I can understand why you've chosen Kenin. And my selection is Novak Djokovic. And I base this entirely on what's happened on the court. If we start factoring in what happened off the court, he would be nowhere near it for me. But this is about on-court performance. And the way he has assembled a 41-5 win-loss record over the course of the year, and the way that he began the year, winning his first... Well, he won 36 matches in a row. He won the Australian Open. He won the ATP Cup with Serbia. And he obviously is the major part of the reason that they won that. He won Dubai and then tennis stopped. He comes straight back. He wins Cincinnati, the event held in New York, and then that freakish event happened in New York. Now, yes, it was his fault, but it was still freakish, and I think he would have won the US Open if that hadn't have happened. Obviously, we'll never know, but I still think when you consider that and the fact that he then won Rome and that he reached the final of the French Open, to me, he's the player of the year.
You don't get to call upon alternate universes, David.
Just did.
In your argument. If that hadn't happened, he would have done this. So let's include that in his list of achievements. No. Matt, who would you like to nominate? Using only current universe arguments, please.
Does the start of 2020 count as the current universe?
That is touché. A very, very good philosophical question.
I've gone for Dominic Thiem. I think, as you've said, more than ever, this was a year where the slams were such a focus of the year, given that we didn't have 5 months of tennis in the middle and that they were there was this condensed period with kind of back-to-back slams. And Thiem won more matches at the slams than any other player this year, male or female, 17 in total. Australian Open final, US Open title, French Open quarterfinal. I actually think that French Open quarterfinal is even better than it sounds, considering he'd just come off the back of winning his first Grand Slam title at the US Open. He didn't play on clay before Roland Garros. And I think there were only three players, men and women, who reached the quarterfinals of both New York and Paris this year, and Thiem was one of them. So that was also a really good showing at a slam. For me, as improbable as it is that Kenin did what she did this year, and Kenin would probably be my second choice, I would say. But I think it's, you don't have to go back far for it to be just as improbable sounding that Thiem would reach the final of both hard court slams and the final of the ATP finals 2 years in a row. This year just felt like a complete validation of all the work he's put in with Massu over the last 18 months or so. And there's now a big debate to be had. What is his best surface? Is it clay? Is it hard court? And that would have seemed inconceivable not that long ago. But I think more than anything, what he's done this year is step into a void that we've felt for so long. Anyone who's had any kind of fatigue over Federer and Nadal and Djokovic carrying on winning everything, they've been waiting for Dominic Thiem, someone who has won a Grand Slam title, broken the big three run of, I think, 10 or 11 slams in a row that they'd won, and also beaten those players along the way, not necessarily at the US Open. He didn't do it there, but he's got a 3-1-loss record against Djokovic and Nadal this season. He's kind of shown himself to be their equal. And he's done all of that without losing what makes him such an exciting player. He's a player I want to watch, and I think there's quite a lot to be said for that as well. So he's kind of the whole package, I think, Dominic Thiem. He's my standout this year.
And he did all of it with frosted tips. You'll be unsurprised to hear that Matt and Dominic Thiem won that category. And as much as I really do believe in my argument for Sofia Kenin, I cannot begrudge Dominic Thiem that win. And if I had to choose one tennis player to watch for tennis purposes at the moment, it would be Dominic Thiem.
Yeah.
I just can't get enough of watching his tennis. So, yeah, a worthy champion. Sorry, David, we regroup, we march on.
I should mention our honourable mentions.
Do.
There was a lot for Rafael Nadal, as David pointed out. The fact that what he did at the French Open, I think, really impacted a lot of people. I think quite a lot of people probably thought he might not be able to do that at the French Open this year, given the different circumstances. And yet he was pretty much just as dominant there as ever. And the way he beat Djokovic in that final was so spectacular. And also tying the Grand Slam record. I think if we had a category achievement of the year, that would probably be it. And it perhaps didn't quite receive the recognition just because of everything else that was going on this year, that those kind of records perhaps felt less important to us. I don't know, but you know, he is now the joint men's leader of Grand Slams with Federer, a record he's been chasing kind of all his career, and this was the year he finally tied it.
Also for Nadal, 790, well actually more than that now, isn't it, weeks in the top 10 consecutively.
Absolutely, yeah, another record he broke this year.
Yeah. Breaking Jimmy Connors' record. He did that just before the O2, and pretty much every pundit that I spoke to during the O2 about that was the record that they were most astonished by, because of the consistency and the physicality and the strain required to maintain that. That was what they were most in awe of.
And when you take into account that he has had injuries, he's had quite a lot of
serious
spells,
serious ones
that he's obviously went. I think that just shows that whenever he's been fit, he's been at the top. He's been racking up points. Obviously, so many of those coming on clay. But
I suppose you could argue that record would make him player of the last 790 weeks rather than player of the year. But anyway.
15 years worth.
It's ridiculous. Any other honourable mentions, Matt?
Well, we had a lot for Naomi Osaka. And I think this is a difficult category because I'm very wary of not wanting to contradict myself. You know, one of the main reasons that I don't see Novak Djokovic as the player of the year is largely to do with his indiscretions off the court. It does impact how I think about his year on the court. I also think you can talk about the fact he's not gained in the Grand Slam race, the fact he suffered that heaviest ever loss, and the default at the US Open was an on the court thing. There's lots going on with Djokovic, obviously incredible results, but I can't take the year he's had off the court out of my mind. So sort of applying that logic, if you are counting off court things, I definitely think the player of the year is Naomi Osaka. And the way I would sort of slightly get out of that hole that I'm in is I would call Osaka the person of the year, for sure, combining on-court excellence with off-court excellence. And we had a couple of really nice tributes to Osaka. Wright Bryan said that Osaka's her player of the year, person of the year, if you like, for her courage, inspiring message, and masterful tennis. And Filoni Macaroni said, for transcending the sport, for giving it meaning and purpose, for being modest and yet incredibly poised and powerful, for carrying the torch, for being a modern voice, and for showing how far being yourself can take you. I thought those were very well put words, and I wouldn't argue against anyone who said that Naomi Osaka was the player, person of the year. And I also noted that she's just been announced among the Sports Illustrated People of the Year. They've gone with a sort of activist athletes as their person of the year, and Osaka is listed among the five that they've chosen. And that, you know, just to put that in perspective, the only tennis players who have won that award in the past are Billie Jean King, Chris Evert, Arthur Ashe, and Serena Williams. So that's the company that Osaka is keeping now, courtesy of everything she did this year, and it's all deserved, I think.
Well, I think it's fair to say, David, that you probably came last in that category. After
according
all of that.
To whom?
Matt has just put you right in your place.
Well, I'm perfectly happy with my pick. And as I said, to me, Player of the Year is on court, and Novak Djokovic did what he did. However, I am prepared to also admit that Dominic Thiem was excellent.
Match of the year. David, you're up.
The one and only Jennifer Brady against...
middling American having a good run in a pandemic.
That was before. she won or she reached the semifinals of the US Open.
She turned into a middling American having a great run in a pandemic.
She turned into one of the most inspiring players I could imagine on that particular night in the semifinals against Naomi Osaka. It was a joyous occasion because you had two players playing at what looked to me pretty much the peak of their powers. Naomi Osaka is just a slightly better player. Well, I mean, she is a better player. And she produced her best at the same time, and you just ended up with this spree of winners. When you looked at the stats, it was it was one of those where you kind of having to do a double take to realize that, to make sure that's actually that they've got that right, but then it felt like that when you're watching the match, the stats, the way more winners than unforced errors is what you felt when you were watching it, and in my case, describing it on the radio. We were covering it in the middle of the night on BBC Radio 5 Live. We'd made the choice that we would cover both semi-finals live because it was a big night of tennis, and also, you know, middle of the night in the UK, there's not that much on. But I don't know how many people were listening, but if they felt anything like how I felt when I came off commentary of that match, they would have felt uplifted. And that's in an empty stadium where there was no atmosphere, and yet they created atmosphere. And they did it on, I think it was it the day that they were celebrating the original nine? Which just felt so fitting. And it's a memory I will take with me from this horrible year and always be warmed by.
Well, I would like to nominate the match that followed that, Serena Williams against Victoria Azarenka, and I would like to take everything that David just said about that match and apply it to my nomination, but sort of with 10% extra on top, because I thought there was no way that Serena against Azarenka, which was supposed to be the main event, I thought, given what happened with Brady and Osaka, I thought it was just inevitable that it would be some sort of disappointment. And it turned out for me to be, look, I can't claim to remember every single one of the 22 matches that they've played, but that was the most gripping and enjoyable one that I can remember watching. And given their ages and the stages of their career, I find that extraordinary that they should be playing their best match of their rivalry now. And, you know, there was the quality of the match, the drama, the comeback, the fact that they're both mothers, and also the fact that a la the 2017 Australian Open and the Federer Nadal final, this was something that we thought we might never have again. I didn't think we'd see Serena Williams and Victoria Azarenka playing this kind of match ever again. And when you think you're not going to have something again, you enjoy it all the more when you do. And who knows, we might not have it again now. I hope we do. But match of the year by far for me. Matt?
Yeah, this was the unenviable task of trying to think of a match that didn't take place on women's semi-final night at the US Open. I decided to go back to January for this one, and Federer versus Milman at the Australian Open. And I'm very wary that I'm probably influenced by the fact that I was, you know, on the Rod Laver Arena watching that match, and therefore had a very visceral experience of it. But basically, it was my favourite genre of tennis match, I think, which is an all-time great in Federer on the ropes against an inspired opponent being pushed to the absolute limit. And I remember being surprised that the match was like that, because they were really hyping it in the Australian media, as you can imagine, you know, a home favourite against Federer. Of course, that's a big night session match. We had John Millman being called a sensation in the hours leading up to this. And, you know, I was sort of thinking, really? I mean, yes, I know he's beaten Federer at the US Open, but that felt so condition-based to me. It felt like Federer just wanted to get off that court and Millman outlasted him. But I actually thought Federer might sweep Millman aside in this match. And that was so naive of me, because clearly Millman causes Federer a lot of tactical tennis problems, and I'm still not convinced Federer really knows how best to play him and how best to beat him. The other thing that gave this match something extra to me was that it took place on that day where we did two podcasts at the Australian Open. It was that crazy day where Serena had lost, Wozniacki had retired, Osaka had just lost to Goff, Tsitsipas had gone out. That is so special when you get a day like that at a slam. It's like a chemical reaction. It's like something changes in the grounds. The atmosphere feels different. And suddenly I did have an expectancy about that match. And I did think, oh my goodness, Federer's in trouble here, because things are happening. This is a day you can't explain. And, you know, the match turned out to be an absolute epic. It went all the way to a 10-point tiebreak in the fifth set, which for me is the perfect ending for a five-set match. You get that moment where you know that for one player, they're going to end the match in rapture and the other player is going to be in torment. And the line between that is so, so thin. And in the end, Milman had a lead, 8-4. The crowd was in this kind of frenzy. And Federer stayed so calm amid that frenzy and managed to win the match. And then he gave a finger wag. He gave the quote about the demons lurking. And I just look back on that now as kind of a legacy-enhancing match for Federer so late into his career, knowing that he was injured. And yeah, it was very, very special. And basically everything was better in January, wasn't it?
I do love any tennis match that ends in a finger wag.
Yes.
I'm a sucker for a finger wag. You made a very valiant case there for Milman against Federer. But of course, Serena against Osaka was the winner. Were there any honourable mentions, Matt?
Yes, we had quite a lot of, I was going to say love, possibly recency bias for Team Nadal at the O2. I mean, that was exceptional.
It was. Quality-wise, it was extraordinary.
Yeah, and Team Djokovic at the O2 as well, that semi-final, which went to a deciding set tiebreak. Krista says Team Gaston at the French Open because it was totally unexpected. There was a lot of guts, heart and drop shots, plus 5.6 million people glued to their TVs in France. And Ali says Team Zverev, the US Open final, not the highest quality.
Nope.
But the first men's match in years where a first slam was at stake for both players and nerves showed that. And certainly as an occasion and as a tennis moment, that match really did stand out and it certainly delivered drama.
I've got just two little additions I'd like to make. One is that I've discovered since the show the other day that I'd written down in notes on my phone back in January, player of the or match of the year contender Kyrgios Khachanov at the Australian Open. Do you remember that one? It was an incredible match, but it's so long ago I just feel like we've all forgotten that.
Matt, was that the one that we tried to get on court for and failed?
Yes, you had a run in.
Did you win?
I had a run in.
No.
Oh. I did not win. No, we didn't see any of that.
You
spent a lot of time
in a
lobby area of the Melbourne Arena.
Yeah, we ended up watching it in Garden Square.
Yes, we did.
David, I think you were commentating on it, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, yeah. It was amazing. The other thing is, I on the subject of finger wags, I think Solihull Simon might have done a finger wag the other day.
That's baller.
Yeah, after coming back from a 1-6 first set when I was playing like Roger Federer. And I was just like I was hitting cross-court forehands to open the court up, then hitting a down-the-line forehand, coming in and just popping away the forehand volley. I did that twice in the match. And I'm going to live off those 2 points for the rest of my life. The problem was he won the second set 6-3 and then the champions tiebreak 10-5. So let's just move.
You've hijacked the award show to sort of commentate non-live on your own loss to Solihull Simon.
Yeah.
Which is also a baller move.
Well, we can move on now.
Hope you enjoyed that interlude. Moving on.
Well, next one's peak weird moment. You can have that.
No, it's not.
Oh, no, it's not.
Stop hijacking.
It's most uplifting moment. It wasn't that. Gee.
Most uplifting moment of the year. Matt, you're first.
Yes, well, having just made a case against those two women's semi-finals, I'm now going to take back everything I've just said, and that was my most uplifting moment, women's semi-final night at the US Open. And the case I made for this is that, you know, tennis had been back for a few weeks by this point, and I hadn't been invigorated by it. I was grateful it was back. I was enjoying it. But I hadn't lost myself in a night of tennis or a match of tennis since it had returned. And that's probably partly because that most often happens at the slams, you know, where the biggest events, the highest stake moments. But, you know, the US Open was fine. It was enjoyable, but there was nothing really sort of spectacular until we got to women's semi-final night. And I remember it just being a realization that even in these times, tennis can be wondrous and you can really be uplifted by a tennis match. And I remember having that feeling, even though it was 3 o'clock in the morning where we were, 4 o'clock in the morning even, I just didn't want it to end. It was such a incredible night of tennis for the drama, the quality, and also, as David mentioned, the fact it took place on the day they were celebrating the original nine. Billie Jean King was in the stadium. It was all so perfect. And yeah, that was the moment for me where I just suddenly felt, oh gosh, yeah, tennis is amazing again. And I hadn't felt that for a while because we hadn't had it for so long.
David?
I went for an off-court moment, which was Coco Gauff's speech at a Black Lives Matter rally. And it was a completely unprepared speech. It was off the cuff. She was invited up and just started speaking. And it was only a couple of minutes long, the clip I saw, but I felt so inspired by it to want to find out about what she was talking about. And I'm thinking, this is a 16-year-old doing this. I'm in my mid-40s and I just feel small listening to this because she's so much more, she's thought about this so much more deeply and is able to put it into perspective that I can't relate to, and I want to relate to it. And I thought, well, if that's happening to me, imagine what's happening to other people watching this and listening to this. And it also made me think, that's really just good for tennis that there's somebody like this in the sport coming through. Same with Naomi Osaka. At a time when Billie Jean King is in her 70s now, the sport needs someone like this. And she just inspired me, and I found it truly uplifting. Long may she thrive, because that was an incredible moment of the year.
And I don't disagree with any of that. I would just say that those feelings that you've described from those two moments, I got all of that from Naomi Osaka winning the US Open and then some. For me, that is by far the moment I felt most uplifted by in this weird, horrible year. You know, I don't think I could put it better than Matt did at the time, and did, I think, on last week's podcast, rather, reviewing the year. That image of her on her back on the Arthur Ashe Stadium, gazing up at the sky with not a crowd member in sight, just contemplating what she'd achieved with her tennis. The fact that, you know, she's a pretty unassuming, shy character, and the fact that she had those masks, the seven masks bearing the names of people that had unjustly lost their lives at the hands of law enforcement in the States, given how outspoken she'd been over the summer, perhaps having the masks wasn't the huge surprise. I found the huge surprise the fact that she told everybody so publicly that she had those seven masks and she intended to wear all seven of them. She came into that tournament with a hamstring injury. She'd withdrawn from her previous match and not played the final of the Western and Southern Open. And yet she comes into the Grand Slam and says, I've got seven masks and my intention is to wear all seven of them. That is not in keeping with Naomi Osaka's character. It was like she was possessed by something. And what she was possessed by was something so much more important than sport. And it did have a sense of destiny about it. And what one of our listeners there, Matt, that you quoted earlier, sent in about her achievement and her outspokenness about Black Lives Matter gave the sport meaning and purpose this year. And what can be more important than that, particularly this year? So it's Naomi Osaka, and clearly she was the winner. And I think Sky might be calling me. Hello, Catherine speaking.
What was Sky calling for? I mean, are they trying to buy the rights to this award show?
Surprisingly, no. They're coming to install internet and telly at my new flat, which I hope you'll all agree and understand is an essential thing. And I'm going to have to abandon this podcast and return to it in a short while after I've dealt with Jamie, the Sky engineer. So Naomi Osaka, obviously the winner, back soon.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Sorry about that, folks. We are back. I've got internet and Sky TV and painted my hair, but I'm back on the podcast train and raring to go. Where were we, Matt?
Did your toilet work yet?
No, it is not. Don't rub it in, David. No. I've got Sky and internet, but no toilet or shower. So next week's podcasting could be interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness
but
for Zoom.
You have your priorities in the right place.
Exactly. I'll be watching Premier League years being smelly. Matt, where were we?
We were just finishing off the uplifting category, and we have some honourable mentions that have come in. Mark Bright says, Iga Świątek's French Open run. The emergence of a brilliant new star is always great to watch, especially one with her game and attitude.
Is he the former Crystal Palace footballer?
Mm. This is like when you ask me for extra information about a shout-out. I'm afraid I don't know.
Come on, Matt, up your game.
I'm going to say no.
If you contact us or back us in some way and you share a name with a person of note... Could you please clarify whether you are that person of note? That would be helpful. Great. Now that point of order is done.
I would say the former Crystal Palace player Mark Bright is scarcely a person of note. No, but I mean, if you're in America,
he came to Queens once. Do you remember that, Matt? David?
Yes, I do. Mm. Prolific, Matt. Before you were born.
Sure, but he's not. Transcendent.
Yeah, it's not messy, is it? It's not Lionel Messi. Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, thank you, Mark Bright, for that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We've also got Jan, who says Nadal's continued realistic view of the importance of tennis during a global pandemic.
Jan Molby, former Liverpool player.
Let's not go down this rabbit hole. We haven't got time.
Sophia says today's tweet of Carla Suarez Navarro hitting tennis balls.
Yes.
Oh, very well said.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely agree with that. Alice Evans saying the bushfire relief work that tennis did at the start of the year. And Badger Boy says just seeing tennis back when at one point it looked like there may be no more tennis in 2020.
Yes. Hear, hear. All of those things were lovely. Category number four is weird moment of the year, or peak weird moment of the year, because obviously the year has been exclusively a collection of weird moments. So there are many to choose from here. I've forgotten where we were with orders. This is category four. So I think it's probably me to go first. And my submission is the 32-minute long vlog, unedited, as he proudly declares multiple times, definitely needed editing, vlog from Stefanos Tsitsipas, posted on the 26th of March. So we're talking pretty early days in lockdown, and he obviously went crackers very quickly. He's got a bottle of Corona in the foreground. He mentions on multiple occasions that the feature is not sponsored by Corona. I mean, no shit. No, no corporate entity is going to want to go anywhere near this. Nobody's watching that thinking, oh, I wonder if this is officially backed by Corona. No. He is sitting in what I assume is his kitchen, but it's lit like a kidnapper's dungeon. And he's wearing an enormous raincoat, sort of, I know what you did last summer style. And he's talking without any punctuation about nothing of any interest whatsoever. You know, at one point he just starts listing school subjects and starts telling you whether he liked them or not. Didn't like physics, did like chemistry. Good to know. And I think the strongest case I can make for this being the weirdest moment of the year was that at the time I failed to make it all the way through. And I thought, for prep for the live show, I'm going to watch this whole video. I'm going to be diligent with my prep. I'm going to be Matt Roberts-like. And I couldn't do it. I could not do it. I got to 17 minutes. So I'm not sure there's anyone in the world that's seen the last 15 minutes of that monstrosity. But if there is...
If you have...
Let us know.
What happened? Okay. Maybe it got good.
Maybe. Who wants to go next? David, you're up.
Well, I'm going to go for Serena Williams walking out onto the Lexington car park stroke center court. They did a very good job putting the tournament on. I don't want to diss them unfairly. But seriously, for the world's biggest tennis star, arguably ever, to walk out onto that little court in front of nobody with a mask on, because at that time that is still something we weren't really used to, and just play out a match the likes of which you would normally see setting-wise in just a local club without anybody there at all. That was so weird visually for me. Serena Williams in Lexington.
Matt?
I've gone for that very weird hour of the year where Diana Jastremska's attempts to support the Black Lives Matter movement and racial equality were splattered all over the internet. For anyone who didn't see it, she posted pictures of herself, I think in the nude, with half of herself painted black. I just don't really understand how anyone didn't say, I don't think you should be doing this. This is not appropriate. This is offensive. And she kind of made things worse with her apology. It was one of those apologies where she didn't say, I'm sorry for offending people and I will educate myself. It was one of those where she said, I'm sorry if it's been misunderstood. And I'd kind of forgotten about this, but it's been picked up again recently by, I think, some TikTok creators have found this post, and it's doing the rounds again on social media. And I thought it had gone away, but it's back, and it's had quite a lot of pickup. Yeah, just a very weird, a weird Yastremska moment.
You could sort of set it to the music, to Ebony and Ivory, couldn't you, and create a really horrific meme. But anyway, it doesn't need to be made any more horrific than it already was. This one, the vote for this was very, very close, almost a dead heat between the three, because there's been a lot of weird in 2020. But Stefanos Tsitsipas wins the day of weird and that category. Were there any honourable mentions, Matt?
There were a lot of honourable mentions. Lots of mentions of those Instagram lives that Djokovic did.
Oh, crikey, yes.
Mm.
With the water stuff and the... Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Lots of mentions of the understandable lack of crowds at the US Open, similar to what David was saying, but such a big event with no crowd. Stuart Hill says, team blocking a 68-mile-an-hour Zverev second serve during the US Open final. That was pretty weird.
Well, I would say I the 68-mile-per-hour second serve was... There's a submission in itself.
Yeah. Claire Evans says the French Open being in September and October.
Yeah, those first few days of the French Open, the sonic boom.
Yes, and Russell Miller points out Kenin Farrow Coachgate from the French Open when Sophia Kenin's dad encroached on
they sat next
Manuel
to one
Plonk.
Another.
Yes, yeah. Very strange. Nathan Smith says dogs on sun lounges indoors.
Not weird, just great, Nathan. Yeah.
Mark McDonald says Bernard Tomic's OnlyFans debut.
What's this? Is this the porn?
This?
Is this the porn thing?
Yes. What?
Yeah, we've not even covered this. But Bernard Tomic doing porn seems to be a thing that's available in the world.
Is it?
Yeah. I know your face is saying, are you sure we're not going to get sued for this? But I believe that Bernard Tomic wants it to be known that his porn is available to buy. For a price, apparently, some people have been disappointed that the price is, in fact, there are some hidden costs. The price of Bernard Tomic porn is actually higher than advertised. So try it out. Let us know whether it's... worth the price tag. I think we've got a new entry for Peak Weird. I think that's won the day, hasn't it? Shall we move on? I'm not sure David can
move on.
I'm not
sure David can say words at the moment.
The next category is Pandemic Faux Pas of the Year. Matt, over to you.
Strictly speaking, this is not pandemic related. It's not a pandemic faux pas. It came about during the pandemic. Let's be honest, I was just looking for a way to shoehorn this in and fit my own agenda. I've picked the Ultimate Tennis Showdown as my faux pas. I do feel like I've said my piece about that. But for the purposes of this awards show, I've really tried to knuckle down and pinpoint the thing that really made me annoyed with it. You know, I could go on about the gimmicky, stupid cards or the ridiculous nicknames, but I understand that some people like that. I mean, for me, that was a massive turn off, but some people got enjoyment out of that, and that's fine. And generally, I am in favor of innovative exhibitions. But I think my biggest problem with the Ultimate Tennis Showdown was the way it was pitched by Patrick Mouratoglou as not just being a little bit of fun. This was genuinely his vision for what the sport of tennis should look like, to bring in new fans. He thinks this kind of radical overhauling of the scoring system to make it shorter, quicker, something akin to the four quarters of 10 minutes that they had at the Ultimate Tennis Showdown. He thinks that is the way forward. And I personally see that as a dangerous, unsettling development. And I think the two big problems I have with that is that that's a scoring system, to me, which completely misunderstands tennis and rips it of its essence and most fundamental element, which is that you have to win the final point. If you don't have that, I just don't think you're understanding tennis. So many of the great matches we relived this year were great because winning the final point became a struggle. And if you can run down the clock, you lose that. And Muratoglu was referring to a report which said that the average age of a tennis fan is 60. And that report has shown to be not nearly thorough enough as a foundation on which to form your radical transformation of the sport. You know, it only surveyed people in America and it only surveyed people watching tennis on TV, not taking into account other countries and streaming services. And I mean, I would love for there to be a proper report into tennis's watchership and viewership and the best tennis minds to come together and think of a way that the sport can be improved, because I think it'd be arrogant to think that it can't be improved. But does it need to be faster, noisier, like the UTS? I personally don't think so, and I would certainly want more evidence. I think it can be tinkered with, but you've also got to trust the sport and trust the viewer, I think. That's what Mary Carrillo says, and the UTS did not do that.
What I should just add is he says that he sees it as running alongside conventional, traditional tennis rather than replacing it. But the manner in which it was presented to us during the period where there was no other tennis, whilst I was pleased that there was some tennis around, or, you know, I applaud the entrepreneurial ambition of it in that regard. It was the way it was shoved down our throat as being exactly what its title is, ultimate, and a showdown that we have to watch. Well, most people I know weren't interested. Now, his argument would be, well, yeah, but it's not for you. It's for all these other people we want to bring in. But we were presented with no numbers as to how many people were watching that format of tennis. And he was asked, how many people have watched it? And he says, we don't give those numbers out. Well, that's problematic to me.
Yes.
David, you've just used your nomination time to agree with Matt.
Well, it's all right. I'll just say,
and if you didn't have such an important one in this category, I would say I would let that slide. But I think you probably do need to
it's fine.
Make your case.
I'm just happy to say the words Adria Tour and leave it at that. You know, because how can there be any more, any bigger faux pas during the pandemic than creating an event in front of packed crowds with ball kids that you're throwing sweaty towels to during a contagious pandemic that's sweeping across the world, partying in nightclubs, limbo dancing with shirts off, one of the players bringing coronavirus into the country, testing positive, apparently passing it across the net to Borna Choric. This was Grigor Dimitrov to Borna Choric. The organizer of the event, as optimistic and hopeful he was that he was doing a good thing for his region, as Novak Djokovic no doubt was, picking up the virus himself, all the players going to get tested, he not, and going back to Belgrade with his family from Zadar in Croatia, and then finding out he's tested positive. Kids' days where people are packed together. Goodness knows how many people might have ended up picking up the virus that we don't know anything about. And the final having to be cancelled as a result. I just do not think it would have been really possible to do anything more wrong in the end.
I mean, sure, a super spreader event that potentially cost lives. But, David, none of that is Night Train.
Or Drip.
Or Drip. But I'm not even submitting Drip. A, because I think Night Train just alone is a worthy submission. And B, I think Drip actually was released not post-pandemic, because we're not post-pandemic, but post-lockdown period. So I'm trying to be strict, because obviously Drip, worthy candidate also. But yeah, some tennis players, you know, became activists for social justice, spokespeople for social justice, tried to campaign for tennis players to receive funding and support during the lockdown period. Kevin Kravitz, the German doubles player, he volunteered at a local supermarket disinfecting trolleys. Lovely. These are all worthy pandemic activities. Well done, tennis players. Some people, you know, started producing podcasts about the past to entertain people. Great. All worthy lockdown activities. Producing rap music that nobody asked you to do, despite the fact that you have no musical talents or qualifications. Absolutely not a worthy pursuit. And if anybody's thinking, yeah, but maybe it's not that bad, maybe, you know, you're just not the right demographic. I realise I'm not the right demographic. But I think objectively, and I'm going to read you the lyrics, objectively, regardless of your tastes, this is terrible. Here is a small lyrics selection. I said I needed food, getting hungry every time I hear a boo, losing track of all the flights that I flew. What did I do to get here? Ain't nobody got a clue. I grind for a living. In my life, I ain't never hit snooze. Look at these views. When I work for it, I ain't gonna lose. Recent results would suggest otherwise. Two Raris in the lot, and I believe that is an abbreviation of Ferraris. Two Raris in the lot, I ain't gotta choose. That's the music he produced during a lockdown, a pandemic, a global pandemic, which is causing financial, social and emotional chaos the world over.
Who won?
Well, I think in a year where I think in any other year, if a super spreader event hadn't been staged in Eastern Europe, I think we know what would have won. But yeah, okay, the Adria Tour won.
Do I celebrate that? Or?
Matt, any honourable mentions?
Sam Querrey.
Yeah, but we don't have the final chapter to that story. We still don't know where he went or how long he was there for or how he made it home. The next thing we saw from him was him off on holiday with a Brian brother.
Yeah, we can kind of carry that one over till next year, can't we?
Yes. And also Alexander Zverev, kind of following on from the Adria Tour, seen in sort of dancing at that party when he should have been self-isolating and then playing with COVID symptoms at the French Open. A couple of terrible faux pas from him.
Tennis has had a lot of faux pas to choose from this year, hasn't it? Yeah, but some uplifting moments too, which we've covered. So what we missed most this year is category number 6. I think I go second here. David, do you want to go first?
Yes. Well, I ended up going for Wimbledon because, I mean, look, I've missed loads this year. I've missed, obviously, the atmosphere, the crowd, all the things that everybody's missed about tennis. I've missed people coming together, really, and all the things about social life and tennis generally that the tours give you. But the thing that I miss most is Wimbledon. I miss Queens enormously, but that's always a stressful event for me because of my role there. As much as I love it, I've always loved it. But Wimbledon isn't stressful for me in my role commentating on BBC Radio. It's an incredible privilege that I get to do that job. But you always know that there's only so many of them in your career, and there's only so many Wimbledons you can watch in your lifetime. I know that sounds very extreme, hopefully I have a long life and can watch many more of them, but to lose one when there hasn't been one lost to us all since the last world war, you know, it's it really hits you that's when that happened. I don't know why, but that just amplified the scale of the pandemic to me. Even though there are far more serious things that people might point to, but in my world, in our world, that's just an ever-present. Wimbledon happens. Wimbledon is such a focal point. And for it to just not exist for a year really hit me very hard, I have to say.
Hmm. I should say that in our long list of nominations for this category, we had a Zoom meeting to go through them and decide what we each wanted to nominate. And the long list, Matt had put each other in what we missed most. And David said, "Yeah, you can cross that off. I've seen a lot of you."
Oh, we've been on this thing every day.
Such a low blow from David.
It was
David.
A really low blow.
But then when I actually started thinking about...
I've spoken to you more than usual.
when I started to think about, well, we've done 150 podcasts together. What more do you want? But when I started to think about Wimbledon, that was part of it, was the memories of us last year sitting on the bench on Henman Hill recording this show every night during sociable hours with the sun setting, with a beer in front of us, with Catherine getting stung by a bee, but you know, there were pluses to that as well. Those were wonderful memories, really. And so I take that back.
We extracted it out of him, Matt. Mm. My submission for this is crowds. When tennis was, well, during lockdown, when we were sort of anticipating tennis's return and it became clear that tennis and sport would have to return behind closed doors without crowds, I think there were a lot of people saying, oh, we'll get used to it. And maybe we have a bit, we've adjusted, but I haven't got used to it and I don't want to get used to it, because crowds are completely fundamental to elite and professional sport. You know, so rarely is my enjoyment of a tennis match, so rarely does it directly correlate with just the quality of the shots being hit, the quality of the actual tennis. It's more often about occasion and jeopardy and stakes and atmosphere, and I feel like all of those things are dependent on, or at the very least heightened by crowds. And my football team, Reading, played on Saturday in front of a crowd of 2,000 people, the Medeski Stadium, for the first time in 9 months. And I wasn't expecting to be emotional about that, because I love Reading, but the Medeski Stadium is not one of the most atmospheric stadiums in the country. It's a very modern stadium. It, over the past season or two, it's struggled a bit for crowds because we've been absolutely rubbish, and Matt can vouch for that from first-hand experience. I was really emotional watching Reading play in front of 2,000 people and hearing crowd noise on Saturday. And I realised that I've been lying to myself about how okay it is and how we're all coping just fine with there not being crowds. We've all been, you know, convincing ourselves that it's fine, and it's not fine. But it's okay for it not to be fine. Mm-hmm. Matt, what have you gone for?
Mine's kind of a mix of both of those two things, really. I was looking for a catch-all term for all the things I've missed this year, and I ended up with travel. Because travel enables you to be part of a crowd or to go to an event like Wimbledon, live tennis events. And yeah, I've really missed traveling this year and having it as part of my life to plan around and look forward to and mark the passing of month to month and season to season. It's such an integral part of why I wanted to work in tennis and be involved in tennis, the ability to travel to the tournaments and try and be there. And, you know, they call it a tour for a reason, I think. I mean, having said that, I know that David feels very sort of strongly that that's something he really hasn't missed this year. And I would say that has been one of the pleasures for us. I think David being able to spend more time at home and being so happy with that has kind of made us happy by association. And I'm aware that people's own personal circumstances will really influence whether or not they have missed travel this year. But just sort of personally for me, it's something that I want to do as much of while I can, and to have not had it certainly since March, has just been a real blow, really.
We have enjoyed the before and after pictures of David watching at the Albion with his 8-year-old son, haven't we? The joy and the hope in the before pictures and the despair / tantrums in the after pictures. Again, worthy submissions, all of them, but Wimbledon did win out. And goodness me, we all hope we'll be back there. I mean, they're planning for three scenarios, aren't they? And all of them are Wimbledon taking place. Obviously, the worst case is without any crowds at all, but fingers crossed that there will be some crowd and Tennis Podcast presence at Wimbledon next year. Matt, any honourable mentions for us?
Well, actually, lots of people said Wimbledon crowds and going to events. Mm. So I think we sort of had the three major ones covered there. The WTA finals had a few submissions. The Olympics had a few submissions, as did Bianca Andreescu and Roger Federer. You know, two players who barely, in Andreescu's case, didn't play, in Federer's case, not beyond January. So
heartbreak emoji.
Mm.
Lots of videos of Bianca Andreescu in training, though. That's looking very promising. So on to category number 7, which is shock of the year. I'm going to go first with this one. And it unquestionably has to be Novak Djokovic's default from the US Open. I mean, what case can I make for other than to say, were you shocked when that happened? Would there have been a single person not shocked to the core when that happened? No. I mean, there wasn't a single person not predicting that Djokovic would win the US Open. There wasn't nobody was foreseeing any scenarios where he could be stopped. And yes, I suppose you could say, well, he's had something like this coming for a while, but not in a Grand Slam, not in a Grand Slam which he was nailed on to win, which would have taken him to 18 in the Grand Slam race. And within two, well, no, he'd have been within one of Nadal at that stage and within two of Federer. Nobody saw it coming. And obviously the aftermath of it with him exiting the site and everything kind of put the icing on the shocking cake. But it was a stop in your tracks moment. It was a moment that made the news and not just the sports news. I always think that's a real measure of how seismic something is. And it will be remembered as one of sports' greatest shocks for years and years to come.
Mm.
Matt?
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to think of anything more shocking than that. That is the standout moment, the one we will be talking about for years. Something else which shocked me this year was Victoria Azarenka's resurgence, because in all honesty, back in January, I had her pretty much in the same category as Wozniacki and Sharapova. Wozniacki had already announced her retirement. Sharapova's felt inevitable. And I thought Azarenka was going that way too. And she herself has kind of said that was what she was thinking. She thought several times about retirement, and after January it was just a case of trying to give it one last go. Tennis then shut down. We came back in Kentucky, and one of the most stark matches I can remember this year was Azarenka losing to Venus Williams 6-3, 6-2 in 80 minutes. And it looked like we had all the evidence we needed that Azarenka's game appeared underpowered and outdated, and she just didn't really have it anymore, and it was quite sad. And then suddenly we turned up at the Western and Southern Open and vintage Azarenka was back. She seemed to go from 0 to pretty much 100 instantly, no gradual transformation whatsoever. And she won the Western Southern Open, only losing one set. She then reached the final of the US Open. And as I said, she was looking pretty much as good as ever. We've already talked about that semi-final against Serena, one of the highest level matches you could ever wish to see. And all of the hallmarks and trademarks of her game, hitting it down the line, the grit in matches, was all back. And it just happened so suddenly. So that for me was a real shock this year.
Mm, it was. I didn't see it coming. I think Daniela Hantikova saw it coming, and we all said, "Oh God, she's gone in a bit heavy on Azarenka, hasn't she?"
Yeah,
absolutely nailed it.
More
not jumping
us
on that bandwagon. David, what you got?
I've gone for the surprise and, to me, shock results of Sofia Kenin and Iga Świątek coming out of this year as Grand Slam champions, because I think it's easy to forget how we would have viewed them as individuals and players at the start of the year. And that's not to doubt that they would never win Grand Slam titles, but to think that they would do it this year, both of them, would have seemed, I think, pretty unlikely, almost absurd. We had Kenin, who was 14 in the world, who'd never got to a quarterfinal at the Grand Slam before and been beaten by Daniel Collins the week before, 6-3, 6-1. Iga Świątek, who was 61 in the world and had been beaten in less than an hour by Simona Halep a year earlier at the same tournament that she would then go and beat Halep, 6-1, 6-2. And also the manner that she managed to win that title, dropping so few games, no set closer than 6-4. That, as a combination, to me, was the biggest shock of the year.
Mm. Well, they were all shocking moments. Now that I'm hearing all of our submissions, none of us came up with the global pandemic, which caused tennis to come to a juddering halt, which feels like it probably should get an honourable mention, Matt.
Too big for tennis.
Yes, there were basically two honourable mentions, and pretty much everyone said either Djokovic's default or the pandemic,
sure,
shutting everything down.
Sure, big year for pandemics. They're creeping into every category, of which we only have one more, and it's a little self-indulgent, so please excuse us this moment, but it's our podcast moment of the year. Many to choose from. Who's going first here? Who went first last time?
Not me. I'm going first this time.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah. And I'm going to go for the moment Matt spoke out on the allegations against Alexander Zverev. I think mainly because it wasn't until we recorded that podcast and Matt said what he said, and I'll just remind you what that was. Even if there was an investigation and if the allegations were found not to be true, I would still find it troubling and disappointing the way Zverev has handled it. Nowhere has he said that I abhor domestic violence, and his voice matters. He needs to be denouncing emotional and physical abuse and saying that it's not okay, in my opinion. I listened to that at the time, and that just made me realise that I was walking on eggshells the way I think many were, and understandably so, I think. There are allegations, he has denied them, but there's a wider point to them than just whether or not it happened. The lack of an investigation of any kind is troubling generally, but his reaction to them was just unsatisfactory to me on every level.
Mm, absolutely. A slightly jarring change in tone alert. My nomination in this category is David's Diego Maradona story. Because I've known David Law for 13 years, I've heard all the stories he has up his sleeve, and hey, there are some good uns. We've all heard them. You've got your being in a lift with Federer and him saying, "Why do I lose all the close matches?" You've got your wading through a pond at Queen's being pranked. Well, not realising you're being pranked, obviously looking for a non-existent engagement ring. You've got your having a blazing row with Marcelo Rios and or Yevgeny Kafelnikov. You've got your kneeling on the court at Queen's during the famous Goran Ivanisevic-Greg Rusedski tiebreak. You've got your crisis comms after the David Nalbandian default. There are lots of hits. 13 years worth of hits, and yet none of those stories is shoulder barging Diego Maradona, almost taking the guy out and getting booed by a crowd full of thousands of people. as I said in the live show, if I had that story in my arsenal, I wouldn't be telling any other stories. I'd just be telling that story on repeat. I'd be introducing myself to people with that story. Hi, I'm David Law. I once shoulder barged Diego Maradona. These were the circumstances. Let's be friends. I'd have business cards made up with it on. So, yeah, after 13 years of knowing David Law and thinking I knew what kind of guy he was, that was my moment of the year. Matt, you've got the last nomination of our 2020 awards.
What By the way, Diego, RIP. Very sad news about him recently.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I now get to complete the circle of us complimenting each other's work as we are calling this award. And I very genuinely think that the podcast moment of the year was Catherine's interview with Leslie Allen, which we included in our podcast on the life and legacy of Althea Gibson. And shamefully, I did not know who Leslie Allen was prior to that interview or the research for that interview. David knew that Leslie had spoken at the unveiling of Althea Gibson's statue at the US Open last year and that she would enrich this podcast episode. And boy, did she do that. It was the perfect interview because she provided not only this amazing insight into the life of Althea Gibson, kind of explaining how she was successful in a world that didn't want her, which was, you know, the real crux of our episode, but she also then contextualized Althea Gibson's life and showed us how her legacy is still relevant and still important. And then she touched on her own personal experience to take the podcast in a deeper direction, and that of Black experience in tennis. And some of the stories and anecdotes she told, I found really, really eye-opening and sad, about draw fixing at a junior and an amateur level, about not being able to walk through the gates behind white tennis players, being stopped at the gates, about how if Arthur Ashe had acted like John McEnroe, he wouldn't have been lauded, he'd have been vilified. All this insight, I think, was perspective that we couldn't provide and that podcast needed.
And that was the winner of that category. Very little to do with me and very much to do with Leslie Allen, who was extraordinary, and is the rightful winner of our final award for 2020. Let's hope that our 2021 awards don't feature pandemic or weirdness related categories, shall we? Let's hope we can return to the boring old fare of Coach of the Year and all that jazz.
Were there any honourable mentions, Matt?
Oh, yes.
There were.
Let's show off.
Daniel O'Connor said Instagram.com.
That was great.
Puello Deer said the Bartoli and Pays interviews.
Yes.
Krista said the Federer volleys are okay saga. David Smith said the Yannick Noah interview was sublime.
Absolutely.
Alex Green said the worst predictions podcasts. Patricia Carter said Mary Carrillo is always a treat.
Yes, Patricia.
And Sonia said, I found myself recollecting Catherine's stone soup story and chuckling many times.
I'll find a scenario in which that is actually relevant one day.
Yeah, that'll be coming up again, folks.
Oh, that was our awards for 2020. That was the year that was. That's not us done for podcasts for 2020. Of course, we're back on Thursday with Matt.
I don't know. What are we doing on Thursday?
Haven't decided yet.
Have we not?
No.
No.
Right. Okay. We're going to be twice weekly for you for the foreseeable future. As we discussed at the start of the show, we don't know what the beginning of next season looks like, but yeah. we're going to be staying with you right the way through. And yeah, I'll remind you one more time that our Kickstarter is still live. So if you haven't backed us and you'd like to support us for next year and help us grow this show and make it the best thing it could possibly be, then yeah, go to kickstarter.com and search for the Tennis Podcast. All the links in our show notes or via our social media, all of those things. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, folks.
Yeah, it's good fun, that.
We don't have any shout-outs, do we? Because our laws were our last shout-outs for 2020. We'll have to wait for our incoming batch for 2021, of which there are already many, but there are spots open. So if you would like your name dissected, I'm missing having names to dissect, then you can pay to do so. Lucky you. Kickstarter.com is the place for that. Thanks for listening. Thank you for supporting us throughout this year. We can't wait to do more next year, and we will speak to you on Thursday.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.